Welcome to Out of Bounds. I'm Tish Perlman. My guest is poet Susan Deercloud. Deercloud is a graduate of Binghamton University, where she received degrees in literature and creative writing. She has received several awards and fellowships, including a National Endowment for the Arts Literature Fellowship. Her poems have appeared in numerous journals and anthologies, including Sister Nations, an anthology of Native women writers on community, Florida Review, Ms. Magazine, and North Dakota Quarterly. She is also author of several collections of poetry, including The Last Ceremony, published by Foothills Publishing, and her most recent is called Braiding Starlight, published this year by Split Oak Press. And welcome to the show, Susan.
Thank you. I'm happy to be here.
Now, tell us about growing up in the Catskills of New York. Growing up country and you're rooted in the mountains and it's paramount to your identity. To tell us about that.
It's a very special experience growing up where I grew up. I grew up in Livingston Manor in what was once known as the Borscht Belt because of the Jewish hotel. So I grew up in the heyday of the Jewish hotel subculture, you may call it. Mm-hmm. And it was a very special place to grow up in because there was this melt of people coming in from New York City, New Jersey, more urban places. And then also with people of very often Scotch-Irish, English background going way, way back in the Appalachian way, who had lived there for a few centuries. Those people were there. And then also Native people, a lot of indigenous people ran back into that pocket of the mountains and lay low and hid out and survived in that way and escaped being hunted down and killed or hunted down and put on a reservation.
Oh, it's an unbelievable history. Did your family infuse you with Native American tales of your ancestors, or was that something that you had to gradually learn as you got older and perhaps more interested in learning your history?
I grew up with a big indigenous influence. My grandfather, who was Native, lived right next door to us. He actually built the house I grew up in and the house he and my grandmother lived in. Our houses were side by side. So my earliest experience was seriously following around behind my grandfather. And it was just a part of my life, the way my grandfather was, the way people in my family were. And I would refer to that way of being Indian in the Catskills as being a life of hiddenness and secrets. Because when I was growing up, for instance, my mother told me, don't tell people about our belief in dreams, that we give attention to our dreams, because if you do, they will think we are crazy or they will think you are crazy. So there was this whole submerged life among Native people when I grew up. And my mother was of that generation especially, and also my grandfather, where Native people were extremely shamed for being Native. So people tended to be quiet about it.
Yeah, that's amazing. It seems like through the 60s and the 70s, a lot of different cultures had to take back their pride and their culture. You know, the gay and lesbian movement, the women's movement, and the Native American movement. Now, tell us when you began writing. Was that a way to weave some of your past to your present and bring back, you know, some of your past life?
I think probably, speaking of past life, maybe it came from a past life, because as early as I can remember, I was a creator, I was a storyteller, and I have very early memories of people telling me stories and of people reading to me. But also, my father used to take us for long drives into the mountains and the backcountry roads, and we used to sing songs. Mm-hmm. And when my family ran out of singing songs, I would create my own songs, my own poetry and stories, and sing them as we were driving in the mountains. But I just knew, before I ever got into kindergarten, I knew what my life was going to be in this way.
Well, I'm wondering, since your family was hidden about your heritage and your culture, and how did you learn so much about Native American culture and tradition? Because there's so much weaved through your poetry.
Right. Well, some of it was given to me in the sense that I grew up being told that everything is pervaded by spirit. I grew up with an emphasis on the natural world. Mm-hmm. Very important. My parents used to take me back into the woods a lot and in the meadows. And I grew up kind of on a borderline because I lived on School Street, so across the street was the school. And I must say I was almost always late to school. And behind the house was a forest that stretched for miles until it came to the Beaver Kill River. But in terms of ceremonies, we didn't grow up with a lot of the ceremonies that have been preserved on the reservations especially. Those were gone from us. My grandfather was put in an orphanage when he was 9 years old. Uh-huh. His mother drowned when she was ice fishing in the Willowemoc River, and she got pneumonia and died. And all the children were put in the orphanage in Binghamton, New York.
Wow.
And my grandfather and my great-aunt Grace especially kept trying to run away from the orphanage. And last fall, I did some research into that orphanage, and I found out that there'd been some extreme abuse of children there at the beginning. And now there's this question, too, in my mind about how my grandfather and the other children were treated. A lot of the kids were farmed out, too. They were kind of used as slaves on farms when they were in orphanages. Very similar in some ways to what the Indian boarding schools were like.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's another way that layers of lost culture were happening
exactly.
to Native American children. Now, and your poetry, it seems to weave the personal and the political better than almost any poet I've ever read. Is that
Thank
been
you.
A conscious thing for you to... I mean, the personal is political is a old saying, and you write it so clearly.
Well, it's become conscious. I'm not... I've been at this for so long, I don't know if it started as being conscious, but the personal is political is certainly a statement I'm most fond of,
mm-hmm.
and I don't see how anybody cannot be political, no matter what they do in their private lives, their personal lives, whether they're actively political or not.
Mm-hmm.
Not being immersed in the community and all this, the society around you, that's a political statement in itself.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Certainly I come from the standpoint where I think we're supposed to be responsible to community and to all the rest of the world and to all of life, not just to human beings.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Well, I want you to read a piece from your most recent collection called Braiding Starlight, and this piece is called Long Time Ago, and it's for Lance Henson. To tell us a little bit about it.
Well, I wrote this poem not too long after I first met Lance Henson, who's a dog soldier. He's a Southern Cheyenne poet who joined the American Indian Movement early on. And when I first met him, I told him I had started the New Indian Movement, WHIM, W-H-I-M. And I asked him if he would join WHIM, and he said, what does WHIM mean? And I said, Woodlands Hotties Indian Movement. And I said, I, a woman, started it. And he said he'd join. So Lance is the first AIM member to have joined WHIM, which is more rooted in our northeastern Native culture. So this is long time ago for the poet Lance Henson, and I'll also dedicate it to his lovely wife, Silvana, who I just met this fall. Long time ago, invisible in the woods, wolves ran alongside us. Long time ago, unseen panthers purred along night branches, gold eyes, many grandmother moons, lighting our path. Long ago, before the wolves were trapped in a gauntlet and clubbed. Long ago, before the great cats were shot into extinction. I have heard it said, long time ago, our hearts greeted strangers like mountain roses fully opened. I have heard it told, we really did know, Indian love medicine, touch so tender, it made us cry tears in shapes of blue deer and brave eagles. Brother in poetry, long time ago, We learned how to condole each other when our hearts closed. Reopen our ears, eyes, throats. Oh, my brother, I am so afraid. The wolves, the panthers, our moon-flowered hearts. Long time ago, long time ago.
Oh, that's gorgeous.
Thank you.
Do you think there's still such a thing as Native American culture nowadays?
Oh, yes, definitely. Very definitely.
Uh-huh.
It's multifarious because some people lump us all into, well, I'm flashing on that old word, that old expression, melting pot.
Oh, yeah.
We're of different nations, and there are differences among us. Here in the Northeast, people tend to be more matrilineal, matrifocal, although that also exists among, for instance, the Diné people, a lot of the Pueblo people in the Southwest.
Mm-hmm.
But we're very alive. We haven't vanished. We are not vanishing, and we continue to keep on being here.
Yeah.
And coming out of the woods as I am, in a manner of speaking.
Yeah, it's remarkable to have survived what went on to your people from this country, you know. Now, you say that one of your goals is to get poetry out of the university and into the universe.
Right.
Tell us what you mean by that. I find that fascinating.
I mean a whole lot of things by that because I've flitted in and out of the university. I've kind of been on the periphery of it. I'm hoping somebody will hire me full-time now because I just got an MFA from Goddard College, an MFA in creative writing. But my concern with the university is that it's too focused. There's too much playing it safe in the universities, not all together. But those of us certainly who teach, who have taught in the universities and even in community colleges, are very aware that the university has become more and more corporate. And this is one of the reasons why I've loved Goddard College so much, because it's a bit of an island in this archipelago of the increasingly corporatized university.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a real problem if somebody is writing, if they feel they have to play it too safe. And again, I'm not saying it's completely like that in creative writing workshops, but to my taste, there's been too much emphasis on craft. And for me, great writing is heart-driven, it's passion-driven, and it takes chances, and some of the rougher places ought not to be crafted out. And also, I used to host readings in Binghamton. I called our so-called tribe of poets and other writers, Binghamton underground poets, wild Indians, and exuberant others, UNC, unincorporated. And I invited everybody in, not just academic people. And it was great. We had people coming in off the street to read with us.
Yeah. Now I think I knew what you mean when you said that, because I'm thinking through the years, I'm a big poetry fan, and I've read poetry, and I've thought, whoa, that's academic. That mm-hmm. poet was looking, you know, over his or her shoulder to make sure they look clever enough to the higher-ups, and they're not really telling us their heart.
I appreciate your saying that, and that word clever, because I've been around a lot of clever people who like taking on Brit wit ways, which is all very well and fine. But to have so much cleverness and that kind of intellectual wit and to not have real heart inside of it, That's something I take umbrage at.
Yeah, I understand that. Now, a lot of writers have talked to me about having to shut off their inner censor so that they can write what they feel. Have you ever stopped yourself from writing about anything? Have you ever censored yourself?
That's something I've thought about, because I know there is more that I want to write about, and some of these private places in our lives, it's not easy for people like me who grew up with secrets and who grew up with keeping everything within the family. It's very hard for me to write about certain matters. And there is a part of me that has a problem with human beings telling everything. I don't think everything
The confessional
belongs.
Poetry, yeah.
Yes, I don't... I've read that kind of writing, which is fine, but I think it's everybody's choice. It's something one has to bring thought to. Certainly in Braiding Starlight, there's a poem in there that I may not have written some years ago, and that's a poem called Fist, about my professor ex-husband, my ex-now-dead husband, Columbus, as I cheerfully call him these days. but it's about his abusing me and about people not seeing it, or people knowing that I was going through a terrible divorce.
And choosing not to see it.
And, well, because I did not have the power that he had. He was a full professor at Binghamton University. And I think this is important.
If you're just joining us, my guest is poet Susan Deercloud. You know, I want to have you read another poem, and this one is called Braiding Starlight, from the title of the book, Braiding Starlight, to tell us about this. My impression is that you just write so beautifully about loss.
And, thank you.
And that's what this is about.
I'm glad I can do something wonderful with loss. This poem was written for one of my closest men friends on earth, the poet Rain Arroyo. He used to describe himself as a gay Puerto Rican poet from the Midwest. And it really was written about a day after he died. So it's called Braiding Starlight for Rain Arroyo. At the meeting of two Indian-named rivers, I wept my goodbye. Your ear glistened into dying cell phone 1,000 miles distant. After you died, I dreamed of birds clustering around me. Birds, vivid colors of tulips, the red kind, your favorite flower. May's moon whirls closer to strawberry moon. Now, wherever I wander, I wear a shawl of bright birds. All day, soft and musical, it rained like your voice. All day, Persian cat purred as she used to whenever you sang. Following spring rain, night rivers rise, drunk and howling. Friend, beloved, this sorrow is braiding starlight.
That's great. God, it's amazing the way poetry can be used to write epitaphs and keep memories alive. And you do that so beautifully. Mm. Now, do you feel like you're in a tug-of-war with your Native American past and the culture that we're having to deal with right now? It feels like it in your poetry in some ways.
I am. I think it's not just Native people who are in a tug-of-war right now. We're in an economic crash. We're in what I think of as the second McCarthy era, and when George Bush Jr. was selected president, a lot of Indians were saying, well, he's going to turn all of America pretty much into one big reservation. And I like being an optimist. I believe in having vision and carrying through with optimistic vision, but I know so many people who are suffering now. I don't have to turn on the TV or the radio to know this. I have all kinds of stories coming into me.
Yeah. So I think a lot of us are in a tug of war with this culture, regardless of where we're from exactly. Tell us about your name, Deercloud. Was that given
Susan
to you as a
Deercloud.
Child?
No, it comes from a dream. And I get all kinds of stuff about this. And this goes back to what I was just saying about Fist. I actually had a dream when I was still married to the professor, and it was about an old Indian man who came to me in a dream in this circular place in the Fort Woods I grew up in, and he told me that his name was Deercloud and he wanted me to take his name. And it was a beautiful dream. It was at night, it was under the stars, under moonlight, the kind of dream my mother told me not to tell people about because they would think I was crazy. And I did not take the name originally. I told it to a friend of mine, non-Native friend, and she said, oh, Susan, you shouldn't take that name because people will think you're New Agey and you're going to get stuff about it. And she didn't use the word stuff, but I'm speaking on your esteemed radio show. So I did not take the name then, and about a year later, this old Indian man came back to me. And he told me again his name was Dearcloud. He wanted me to take his name. And he took me into his arms and started round dancing with me in this circle in the dream. And for anybody who knows about Indigenous ways, the circle, of course, is very important to us. The round dance is important to us. It goes back to our creation story and the whole creation of Turtle Island. So then I took the name, and then I get stuff from people. And
but that must have been very empowering for you to be able to do that.
It was empowering. It was empowering, and it helped me to get on with my journey, get out of an abusive situation, and do what I have to do in life. So that's what I've been doing.
It's a gentle name, and you seem more of a warrior woman in your poetry to me.
Thank you.
It's true. I was saying that's a very gentle name for this warrior woman while I was reading your poetry.
Thank you. I didn't ask him why, but in some way it keeps making sense to me. It is beautiful. Yeah. And
because deer are resilient, strong, and gorgeous, and graceful. So it's,
thank you.
They're not necessarily weak animals the way people think, just because people can shoot them, right?
Thank you. And the person who starred Turtle Island, if you don't know this story, in our creation story, the Haudenosaunee creation story, begins with a woman who fell from the sky. She had been gotten pregnant by an older man, a chief. And there's a whole long story involved in this. But she fell from the sky. Some people say the chief pushed her through a hole in the sky. And she fell onto the back of a turtle. And she started round dancing. She started walking in a circle round dancing. And that expanded the back of a turtle floating in a vast sea.
Wow.
And that's if you hear the term Turtle Island, it refers to that. The beginning of life.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Well, beautiful. That's such beautiful legacy to have. You describe your religious views as Catskill Native poetic. Tell us more about that.
Did you get that off Facebook?
I got that off someplace on one of your biographies that you gave me. tell me what you mean by that.
I just see Catskill Indian people are a particular breed of people. And again, our whole way of being was very earth-rooted, not reservation-connected, very important. Mm-hmm. I'm descended from a Mohawk medicine woman who hid out in the Mongop River Valley. And she actually died running medicines to a sick child during a storm. She was knocked off a bridge into Mongop Creek, and she died. That's mm-hmm. how she died, helping a child. So that with the native poetic, I grew up around poetry. I grew up around Mohawk Chief Tom Porter refers to his 3D language.
Mm-hmm.
I grew up around Catskill storytelling, both from Indian people. People used to use the term par Indian when I was growing up, and non-Indian Northern Appalachian people.
Mm.
And the language was extremely rich, very, very rich language, with a lot of music to it, a lot of flowing, kind of river flowing. In a sense, I always think about the older Catskill way of speaking as carrying all the breezes in the trees, the sound of the streams, birds, those kinds of rhythms,
yeah.
So
music
hard.
Was actually immersed in nature.
Very, very, mm-hmm. in the whole way of speaking. Mm-hmm. The whole way of speaking. It's a very, very beautiful way.
Wow. Now, before we run out of time, I do want you to read a piece from a previous book. This book is called The Last Ceremony. And the piece I want you to read is called The Only Ceremony We Have Left to Us. To tell us a little bit about it, too.
Well, the only ceremony we had left to us ties in with some of what I've been speaking about today. That whole matter of having language and traditional ceremony and so much of our past life stolen from us. And this is a poem dedicated to three other Native poets, Lance Henson, Ron Welburn, and Sarah Little Crow Russell. And I read this after a gathering I had with them. The only ceremony we had left to us. I am not going to pretend. The only ceremony we had left to us was taking rides in a dented Chevy on dirt roads no city slickers could find. The only ceremony left to us was stopping at a path we mountain Indians knew about, stepping behind one another, hands brushing the bent ferns. The ceremony never stolen, was walking a stony trail to a cliff where we made our stand with oaks, spruces, maples, a few surviving hemlocks. I am not going to lie. We still had a family, in some ways a tribe. But our prayer was staring across valleys at Catskill peaks answering us with blue. My brothers, once I dreamed of Cheyenne stallions and Cherokee fire. My sister, once I cried for Chippewa bear medicine when they cut my tongue. Can I pretend otherwise? The last ceremony left to me is riding the broken horses of love off cliffs.
Oh, that's great. That's really great.
Thank you.
Now, I want to ask you this, too, because a lot of your poetry talks about what one would consider stereotype Native American behavior. Too much drinking, failing in schools.
Oh, we never drink.
No, but do some of your, I mean, just like your parents wanted you not to talk about being a Native American, are some of your Native American friends a little bit peeved by the fact that you're talking about stuff like that in regard to your own people?
Well, my brothers are peeved about, I heard my brothers are peeved about one poem in which I referred to their behavior at a wedding when they were trying to get me to get a sugar daddy to take care of me. At the time I was 58, I said, what would I do with a 100-year-old sugar daddy? What would a sugar daddy, a 100-year-old sugar daddy do with me, drool all over me? But we don't drink all the time, okay, everybody? We all have jobs. We work hard. I have 3 college degrees. Please understand.
I'm sure
everybody else, other people drink, too.
Yeah, no, I'm sure people understand that.
We don't spend our lives doing this.
There have been quite a few Irish writers who have written about that subject as well.
I have Irish in my background. I'm doing great.
we only have a couple minutes left. What are you working on now? Anything new? Any new themes?
I am. Well, I just completed my MFA thesis, which is called Borscht Belt Indian. And
are you going to publish it?
I already have people who are interested, and I call it memoir poetry. What's really calling to me now is to write a prose memoir about that part of the Catskills and about Native people in that particular part of Turtle Island.
Oh, I hope you do.
It would be nice to get a fellowship right now.
You didn't.
A big one.
Well, we are almost out of time. Do you have any contact information, any way for people to get in touch with you and perhaps buy your books through you? Or
Facebook, My Home Away From Home, Susan Deer Cloud. So, or they can email me at susan.poetrymatters@gmail.com. Okay. But Facebook is a good way to go.
Well, that's great. Well, Susan Deer Cloud, thank you so much for sharing this wonderful work with us and parts of your life. It's just been so valuable.
You're welcome, and it's been great. I appreciate it.
Our audio producer is Nate Richardson at Rep Studio in Ithaca, New York. If you'd like to make a tax-deductible donation in support of the Out of Bounds radio show, please contact our fiscal sponsor, the Arts of the Southern Finger Lakes, at earts.org. That's earts.org. Our theme music was composed by Diego Vega. And visit us online at outofboundsradioshow.com. We'll be back next week. I'm Tish Perlman.